Good morning, and it's great to see the place so well filled again. There have been many celebrated engineering and building projects down through the ages. The Great Pyramids, the Great Wall of China, the Roman Colosseum, we've had the Taj Mahal, the Eiffel Tower, the Panama Canal, the Golden Gate and the Brooklyn Bridges, the Empire State Building, and the Belfast Odyssey. Well, this morning we'll be thinking about another great construction project, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem under the direction of Nehemiah, God's engineer, who completed his job in a mere 52 days. So if the title of our previous study was Nehemiah's Burden, this week it is Nehemiah's Project. Indeed, we might label it Project Jerusalem. And as before, having completed some analysis of the text, then I'm going to draw out three lessons. And I said that each time one of those lessons would focus upon a particular aspect of Nehemiah's leadership qualities. In fact, this week, to be honest, nearly all three of them reflect something about Nehemiah's leadership qualities. But let's turn to our text then for today, and we're going to read Nehemiah chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my requests." So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. By night, I went out through the valley gate towards the Jackal Well and the Dung Gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on towards the Fountain Gate and the King's Pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through. So I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. They replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." And you've no idea how difficult that was for me to read that with these glasses, which are not strong enough. Our text is readily divisible into two main sections. Verses 1 to 9, relating to Nehemiah's dealings with the king, and then verses 11 to 18, Nehemiah's dealings with the men of Judah. And I am, of course, aware there are another three verses, verse 10 and verses 19 and 20, but they really concern Nehemiah's enemies, and that's going to be our focus for our next study. So Nehemiah's dealings with Artaxerxes, verses 1 to 9. First of all, we're told when Nehemiah made his approach to the king. It was the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign. Now that, the historians tell us, is March or April 444 BC, if you're really interested. As we noted last time, this was actually about 4 months after Nehemiah had received his brother Hanani's report of the sorry state of Judah and Jerusalem. 4 months in which Nehemiah prayed to God in anticipation of an opportunity to act upon this deeply distressing news. Nehemiah is performing his cupbearer's duty, bringing wine to the king. And Artaxerxes is discerning and spots that Nehemiah's countenance is more than a little sad. Now, we must appreciate here that for Nehemiah to appear downcast before the king was actually a dangerous strategy. As indeed he confesses in verse 3, "I was very much afraid, for this went against Persian courtroom etiquette." You know, to appear anything but cheerful in the emperor's presence was risky, for you were expected to be glad to be in his regal presence. Moreover, Artaxerxes wasn't the sort of individual that you wanted to get on the wrong side of. This was the man who had disposed of his own brother in order to seize the Persian throne. And Nehemiah responds to the king's interjection with a mixture of diplomacy and courage. May the king live forever, a declaration of loyalty and respect. But then, why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Some of the commentators point out that he doesn't mention, although he mentions Judah, he doesn't mention Jerusalem by name. And they speculate that that might be because Jerusalem did possess a bit of a reputation for rebellion, so maybe better not to actually spell out the name of the city. But what he does do is he alludes to the city where my fathers are buried. And you see, the Persians were known to have a deep respect for ancestry. So we may assume then that Nehemiah's choice of words has actually been carefully thought out. The king then asks him to, you know, spell out, what is it that you want? And Nehemiah's instinctive response is to pray, a quick prayer or an arrow prayer, as it's been called, before he actually answers the king. And note that Nehemiah is obviously well thought of in the Persian court, for in making his request of the king, he appeals to his own good character. If your servant has found favor in your sight. And then Nehemiah just goes for it. Please allow me to go to the city of my ancestors to rebuild it. Naturally, the king wants to know, well, how long is your journey going to take and when will you be back? For how long will you be furloughed? I wonder, did he get 80% of his salary? We're not actually told for how long his leave of absence will be, but an agreement is made. As it happens, Nehemiah would actually serve a 12-year term as governor of Judea. So either his furlough kept being extended, or the king happened to be in a very generous mood. Maybe Nehemiah had served him up a particularly strong vintage wine that morning. Nehemiah is now on something of a roll. Could the king give me letters forcing the governors of Trans-Euphrates to guarantee my safe passage on the way to Jerusalem? And while you're at it, king, could you throw in a letter to Asaph? He's the keeper of your forest, so that I'll have a supply of timber for when I get there. Nehemiah certainly had a good day at the office, for the king even throws in a cohort of army officers and cavalry to accompany him on his trek. But note to whom Nehemiah assigns the credit. Not Artaxerxes, not his own skill or boldness, but, verse 10, because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted me my requests. Glory to God, not to man. It's from this first section, then, that I want to draw out two of this morning's lessons. And the first is the particular aspect of Nehemiah's leadership qualities that I want to sort of lay stress upon. And that is the quality of courage. Courage. There can be no doubt that Nehemiah exhibited tremendous courage in making his bold approach to Artaxerxes. Nehemiah was taking his life in his hands by appearing crestfallen in the king's presence. And make no mistake about it, what he was asking for was no small thing. Nehemiah was evidently a senior and highly esteemed member of the king's court, yet he was requesting to be relieved of his duties for a not inconsiderable period of time. Also, and this isn't something that you'll get from the text of Nehemiah, you need to go to the book of Ezra to find this. But actually, what Nehemiah was asking Artaxerxes to do was to reverse his earlier decision to put a stop to the rebuilding of Jerusalem's walls. We learn from chapter 4 of Ezra that regional governors and officials had sent a letter to Artaxerxes claiming falsely that what lay behind the previous attempt at rebuilding Jerusalem was a plan of the Judahites to rebel against their Persian overlords. And that had been enough for Artaxerxes to put an end to the rebuilding work. That was that which had occurred as a result of Ezra's efforts. So Nehemiah was now actually asking Artaxerxes to reverse his earlier decree. Obviously, this took genuine mettle on Nehemiah's part. And the fact that Nehemiah admits to being very much afraid only actually adds to the courage that he displayed before the king in making this request. The reality is that all true leadership requires a measure of courage. And that applies certainly within the church context. We all know difficult situations arise and they have to be dealt with. And it's not always possible to deal with such situations without confrontation. It isn't easy, it isn't pleasant, but it cannot be ducked. Sometimes it's maybe just the courage needed to advocate change, to experiment with a new approach, to strike out on a new course, even knowing the risks of opposition and setbacks. Or it might be the courage needed to stand for truth or for biblical morality in the face of an increasingly unsympathetic, even hostile environment. But godly leadership does require courage. Second lesson is to do with human responsibility. Reliance upon God doesn't abolish human responsibility. Nehemiah was a man of faith. And as we saw last time, he was most certainly a man of prayer. Indeed, even in the heat of his encounter with Artaxerxes, he still offers his sort of telegraph prayer to the Lord before he responds verbally to the king's inquiry. But what ensues reveals that Nehemiah has clearly engaged in much preparation for this meeting, for this occasion. He has thought through, for example, the need for letters of authority to prevent his opponents from stopping the project in its infancy by waylaying his journey to Jerusalem. Moreover, he has researched his supply chain for the timber that he's going to require for the project. Evidently, Nehemiah has engaged in diligent planning. You see, depending upon the Lord doesn't obviate the need for planning and strategic thinking. In fact, it is this combination of reliance upon God and human responsibility which will be witnessed again in the book of Nehemiah, especially in chapter 4, where we read of Nehemiah praying to God and posting a guard. Prayer and vigilance went hand in hand. As we in Castlereagh Fellowship seek to serve the Lord in our community, we need to pray. For after all, it is His work, and we can accomplish nothing except through His power. But that doesn't mean that we refrain from planning. We possess a responsibility to exercise our minds, to think through the options, to devise strategies, to take preventative measures. God expects us to give Him our best and to employ the gifts that He has granted us to further His kingdom. Just as we should never try to do things purely in our own strength, without any sense of dependence upon God, and without any recourse to prayer, so we don't just hand things over to the Lord and lie back doing nothing. That is not the way it works. So that's the first two of this morning's lessons: the need for courage, but also human responsibility must go side by side with reliance upon God. So let's go back to our text then for our second section, which is Nehemiah's dealings with the men of Judah, verses 11 to 18. And first, we should note how, typically, Nehemiah downplays his journey, simply stating that I went to Jerusalem. What Nehemiah doesn't tell us was that this was a 900-mile journey from Susa to Jerusalem, which he didn't complete by plane, train, or automobile. Commentators also like to point out that Nehemiah took a 3-day period to recuperate, and they make the sensible observation that rest is important in the work of God. But after his 3 days recuperation, Nehemiah then conducts a nighttime reconnaissance mission, accompanied by only a few men and telling no one the purpose of his expedition. For clearly Nehemiah had no wish to alert his enemies to his plans. And also, he wanted to be sure that he understood the scale of the task before he would seek to persuade his countrymen to back him. And thus, under cover of darkness, he makes his way around the 2.5-mile circumference of the city, surveying the broken down walls and the incinerated gates. And it's only after he has gathered all the information firsthand that Nehemiah then shares his proposal with his fellow Judahites. To convince them of its merits, Nehemiah stresses 2 things. First of all, the sheer disgrace of the present condition of Jerusalem. Its lying in ruins reflects badly upon Yahweh in the eyes of the surrounding nations. And secondly, he tells them that God's hand has been upon him in his dealings with Artaxerxes, how he has been shown great favor and has been authorized and equipped to launch a rebuilding mission. And this proves to be sufficient to get his countrymen on side. Verse 18, they replied, "Let us start rebuilding." So they began this good work. And that takes us to our third and our final lesson for today. And that is to do with the importance of motivation. Motivation. Any good leader must be able to motivate those in his charge or her charge. Nehemiah succeeded in getting the people of Judah to buy into his rebuilding project. And as the next chapter of the book will make clear with its famous tagline of "Next to him, next to him, next to him," all strata of Judean society, officials, craftsmen, laborers, men, women, townsfolk, farmers, priests, laymen, all signed up to the task, all got their hands dirty as they gave themselves to this work. And we mustn't underestimate just what Nehemiah did achieve here. Recall that the last attempt at rebuilding Jerusalem had come to an ignominious end, and the city had now lain in ruin for many a year. Moreover, the people would have known that Jerusalem's enemies would not look kindly upon this rebuild, notwithstanding Nehemiah having the king's authorization for the project. And further, don't underestimate the extent of the sheer physical challenge that this rebuilding work entailed. Huge boulders would have to be transported back up Jerusalem's slopes, and that without the aid of cranes and trucks. And yet, within a remarkably short period, just 52 days, walls measuring at least 18 feet in height, 9 feet in width, and some 2 miles in length would be erected. This was a truly great engineering feat, all executed by ordinary men and women who expended huge energy and toil in seeing the project through to its conclusion. If we are going to achieve meaningful things for the kingdom of God, then we do need to be motivated to do so. Where does that motivation come from? Partly, yes, the example of leaders. But ultimately, it must be through an appreciation of how great our God is, and a desire to see his name glorified amongst mankind, but also through a burden for lost souls, a desire to see sinners saved and coming to know our wonderful God in a personal way. And we should also be aware that God does promise his people that he will reward them for their endeavors. Any effort that is expended, any task that is fulfilled, will receive his eternal blessing. So let us, in Castlereagh Fellowship, follow in the footsteps of the people of Judah and put our shoulders to the wheel. Let us, as we seek to fulfill the great commission of taking the good news of Jesus to a lost and broken world, let us, put our backs to the task, pointing men and women to the glorious eternity awaiting those who place their trust in him and who give their lives for the sake of his great name. Amen.